Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, my fine friends. Welcome to episode 296 of Rahalasta Pub. We've done way more than that, but still, it seems magical. Episode 300, I will be the guest, and John Robbins is going to be interviewing me. We might even do it in front of a live audience, if time and disease allows. But I'll let you know about more about that later. Meanwhile, you can keep watching these live on Wednesday nights on my Twitch channel, twitch.tv/RK Herring. We've got Stevie Martin, we've got John Cairns, we've got Ed Gamble, and loads more to come. And as lockdown will inevitably continue, this will probably go on forever and ever, though there may be a chance of doing some live ones soon. My book, The Problem with Men, is out on November the 5th, not November the 19th. But you can get it on November the 5th, so you're ready for November the 19th. You can pre-order now wherever you get your books, e-books, or audiobooks. I've just been recording the audiobook this week. It's a lot of fun with lots of extra content, including Deborah Francis White chatting about feminism with me for an hour, and Alistair Green reading out some of the funnier tweets from the day. So there's lots of bonus content on the audiobook if you want to get that. Also, Taskmaster starts on the 15th of October on Channel 4 on 9 p.m. I'm back on the telly. I don't need you anymore. This is it. It's over. I never liked you guys anyway. I was using you to get back on the TV, and it only took 12 long years of podcasting. Now I'm famous again, and I don't need you. So, anyway, I hope you enjoy Rahalasta number 296 with the incredible Michael Fenton Stevens from Radioactive, The Chicken Song, and pretty much every comedy show of the last 20 to 30 years. He's a wonderful, lovely man, and you are going to love this interview with him. He's brilliant. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Rahalasta. Hello, welcome, a man who's broken his knobs. It's Richard Herring. Hello, welcome. Thank you for joining us. So we're going up a touch late. We've had some technical issues. Hopefully they're all sorted out now. Welcome to Richard Herring's Left Wing Satirist Terminated podcast. Oh, yes. That's what we call it. We're only doing right-wing jokes from now on. That's the new, so we can get back on the BBC. That's the new direction for the podcast. I think Brexit's going great and Boris Johnson's doing a brilliant job. We cannot take the piss out of the government anymore. That is, and I want to be alive when the fascist state takes over. So I for one, welcome our new fascist overlords. Could be called the Leicester Square Theatre tonight. Look, oh, go that way. Oh, it doesn't really help. Look, we're at the Leicester Square Theatre. Really, we're really there. How amazing. Though I was hanging around at Legoland the other day, and a man dressed as Unikitty, that's Unikitty if you don't know who it is, posing for socially distanced photographs with small children, says he calls it Rahelastopus. I don't know if that's going to catch on. Hopefully it will. Legoland, this was our big bank holiday treat back at the end of August, if you're listening or watching this in the future. And took the kids to Legoland. They were a bit too young for most of it, I have to say. My daughter was, we queued for an hour for a ride that my son was too small to get on and my daughter was terrified by. And that was the start of our wonderful trip. My favorite thing, though, was I saw a quite hard-looking guy wearing a Slipknot hoodie. That's Slipknot, if you're not aware of them. But the effect was slightly diminished by the fact he was carrying a sort of purple fluffy unicorn for his daughter and had just exited a fairy tale boat ride that looks like this. So that sort of is parenthood down to its essence, how it's distilled into what it destroys you and everything you once stood for and creates these juxtapositions. But we're still people. We're still people, parents. We're still allowed to like Slipknot. I love them. I love their old, back there, music. Hello, I'm in Slipknot. That's my favourite of the Slipknot songs. They're very good. And I made it to Edinburgh. I made it to Edinburgh this week as well. Incredible scenes. Thought I wouldn't get there, but for the last day of the Fringe, there I am by Edinburgh Castle. I made it up there. It was good to be back, just even though we couldn't do the Fringe this year. That's Legoland, you idiots. I'm in Legoland. It's an Edinburgh Castle in Legoland. I'm still in Legoland. That's all that's happened to me. All I'm doing in my life is streaming and looking after kids. That's it. We went to see some dinosaurs in Nebworth. The kids ate their dinner. They ate their picnic. It was really cold, so they sat in the boot of our people carrier car and ate their sandwiches. They were very excited. But in the 70s and 80s, that's how we used to travel around. It was a better time, wasn't it, in the 70s and 80s? The kids just put them in the boot with all the suitcases. No one cared. No seat belts. Don't worry. After Brexit, we're all going back to that. And Brexit is a brilliant thing. See, right-wing comedy's easy. It's fantastic. We'll all get to go in cars with no seat belts and just be sat amongst suitcases. And if we crash, the suitcases will probably protect us. That's the way I look at it. And I've been arguing all day on Twitter. I've been sitting in a garage waiting for my car to be mended and they haven't even really mended it properly. And arguing with people about whether all comedy is political. And it's got right on my tits. People saying, oh, I said, is a fart political? People going, yes, it can be. And I said, but is it always? No, let's not get into it. Let's not get into it again. Not everything's political all the time. But it will be soon. Anyway, let's welcome our amazing guest this week. It's hard to choose what he's best known for. He's best known for so many things. You wouldn't believe it. I think he's probably best known for playing Mr. Sour Grapes on Hotel Trouble, though he was also Miles on Mike and Angelo. Come on. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Michael Fenton-Stevens. There he is.
Hello, how
are you?
He's
in the Leicester Square Theatre with me.
Look, it's a problem. Hello, crowd. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Please Quieten Down, Quieten Down.
How are you doing, Michael? Lovely to have you.
I'm very well. It's lovely to be here. It's really exciting to turn the tables, as it were, because I've done a podcast with you.
I have been a guest on yours.
Yeah, and now we're going the other way around, which is...
And now I'm going to rip you apart.
I never thought you'd be stupid enough to do it, but, you know, here you are.
Well, we've had a lot of young people on recently, so I thought it's time something for the grandmas.
Someone very close to their grave, you know.
We're going to talk about a lot of shows that most people watching will not remember.
No, and we'll be lucky if I remember them.
That's so long ago. Do you remember being... well, let's talk about Miles from Michelangelo. Remember being Michelangelo? Do you remember the premise of Michelangelo? This is one of your earlier jobs,
now,
I think.
You've done a great job there because you've just about chosen the only thing I have no memory of at all. Nothing.
I vaguely remember the show. There's something about an alien, I think. There's an alien and there's an American in it and they...
Oh, God, yeah.
I vaguely remember it. I think it was a kid's TV TV show, which I vaguely remember.
I don't know. Yeah, I remember Hotel Trouble.
There's 100 acting credits.
I can remember.
Hotel Trouble. Do you remember Hotel Trouble?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, yeah. We filmed it on sort of an industrial estate somewhere near Heathrow Airport, which also meant that every 45 seconds we had to stop because an aeroplane went over.
Yeah.
I mean, great. Well done. Good idea. Let's open a television studio here, right next to the runway of Heathrow number 4. It was ridiculous. It was cheap, yeah. It was very, very cheap. And the thing I liked about it is that at some point in that thing, I had to be bald.
Right.
And they couldn't afford to get one of those bald caps and stick it on and everything. The makeup was too thin. And the woman said to me, this is fine. What we do now is we spray it with lacquer, really, really fine, and we flatten it right down, and then we'll paint your head, and it'll be fine. And actually, it really did work. But the lacquer and the paint combined to make it go completely solid. It was like I was wearing some sort of bowl on my head. And then they didn't have facilities to wash because we were on a housing estate in, an industrial estate somewhere near Heathrow. So they didn't have a shower or anything. So I drove home that night and I got home and went in and there I was bald. I mean, completely bald. And my wife said, "What the fuck have you done?" And I said, I just thought, they said, could we shave it? And I said, yeah, sure. She said, but you won't be able to work for months. What if you're an idiot? She was completely fooled by it. So obviously the makeup was good.
Well, that's good. It works. And yeah. Then all your hair fell out because you had to
almost,
it out.
Almost. When I did it, there were great clumps of it coming out. Because, and as you can see, it's come back thick and lush and gorgeous.
Wow. Well, I hope I could I'm tempted just to go through IMDb, every single acting job. I said 100 acting credits. That's extraordinary.
Yeah.
There's lots of big things we could talk about. But I think what's amazing about your career is you've been in sort of everything. Right.
Lots of things.
In the last 20 or 30 years.
And the wonderful
thing
is,
one episode, nearly everything.
That's exactly it. I'm in one episode. I mean, so I wasn't good enough to keep around. You know, they went, yeah, bring him in for one and get rid of him.
Just super sub, come in, make a big splash.
I am the Ole Gunnar Solskjaer of acting. Yes. That's who I am.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Come in, winning goal, get the European Cup, and then go home. And then I might go and play for someone else.
But well, we were again before we started. We briefly mentioned Only Fools and Horses, which is one of it's one of the most famous television programs in the world. So it's one of the more notable programs you've been on. But the character you played on that of the guy from the group, was it the Groovy Gang?
The Groovy Gang, yeah. I was the holiday rep on the episode where he wins a painting competition because he has to pretend he's
such a memorable episode.
It's often voted the best, apparently.
Yeah.
And to this day. Almost every day I get a Facebook, somebody gets in touch with me or on Twitter and they say, just groovy and put a thumb up, and I sort of, I think, and I can't resist it. I just go, yeah, groovy back, like some sad old thing, just groovy. And then that's it. We're friends. That's it. Because I've responded. We're best mates. Actually, I had to give Rodney a Groovy Gang badge. Idiot. And I do have it. It might be around here somewhere. I do have it, some of the actual Groovy Gang badge from that thing, which I'm fairly sure, knowing how much money people from Only Fools and Horses get paid for things that they own, that is worth
it.
Hey, get it on there. Could be worth money. But no, what I did was I got fed up with people saying, you haven't got a Groovy Gang badge, have you? And I said, no, why would I? I'm going to bring 500 home with me after the recording. And actually, I could have done. They did have bags of the bloody things. And so I had them made. I got in touch with those badge makers. I designed it and did it as it was originally, had it made. And now I have these Groovy Gang badges. And actually, when people say to me, can I have a Groovy Gang badge? I say, yeah, you can.
Yeah. Do you have them with you at all times in case that happens?
I have pockets clinking and chinking all the
time.
If
it had been the only job you'd ever done and you were doing that, I think that would be quite tragic. But seeing that you have done other work, if that was your only job. I'm the guy, it's me. Me from the Groovy Gang.
Groovy, everyone.
Just giving people the badges before they've asked. Can't you remember?
Walking down the street.
How were the... I'm quite obsessed with Nicholas Lyndhurst. I don't think you were in this one. Good Night, Sweetheart. I don't think you did.
No, I didn't do Good Night, Sweetheart. No.
Yes, I found the one program you did do.
Lovely program. I like that.
I'm quite obsessed with Lyndhurst.
Yeah.
He's very professional. I think they're both very professional, are they? Or he's... They take it very seriously, I think, don't they?
They do. He did. Which is, I mean, actually, I'm not sure all the way. The thing I remember about rehearsals for Only Fools was that, in fact, when, you know, everybody else was rehearsing, he was going through the property pages and looking at, I remember him saying, that's a nice flat, isn't it? And he spent the whole time basically saying, I'm getting paid a fortune here and I'm going to set myself up. So every week he'd get his wages and every week he'd buy a flat in Chelsea.
Right.
And now must have the most extraordinary property portfolio, a bit like Hugh Grant. And, you know, there are a number of actors who've done that. They've taken that one moment of success and they've set themselves up. Unlike you or I, Richard.
Yes.
Clearly.
Well,
what we did was we went down the pub.
Fritted it away. We were like Rodney. We were like the real Rodney.
With the real
we
ones,
just
yeah.
put it in schemes. He invested wisely and I'm sure has done very well.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the beginning to start with,
okay.
Because I think that's you. I mean, you had success very early, really. You were in an Oxford Review in about 79. I want to
say
that's
right.
Yeah,
79 Oxford Review,
and which was only 8 years before my Oxford. I was 89 years. I was 88, I think.
Wow.
We'll have done exactly the same things because when I talked to Michael Palin, he'd stayed in all the same places.
Yes.
You will have stayed in Edinburgh. We stayed in, you sleep in the Johnston Terrace.
Johnston Terrace, yeah.
The Masonic Lodge.
Yes.
And you had sort of discovered, which was still possible then. You were the year after Rowan Atkinson, so I guess the Oxford
it's a difficult act to follow, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, because everybody was saying, "Oh my God!" But what it did, of course, was it brought everybody to see our show because they thought, you know, Rowan Atkinson was last year. Let's see who there is this year. And in fact, the person that they noticed, I think, probably in our review, was the writer. None of us as performers were really picked up immediately because a lot of the stuff was written by Richard Curtis.
Oh, okay.
Because he'd written Rowan's stuff and everything. And he was also up in Edinburgh at the time doing the one-man show with you know, I always thought it's strange, isn't it, that Rowan Atkinson has a one-man show which has another person in it.
Yes.
It would be like you being the other person, you know, in the Stuart Lee show.
Yes, just well.
Now, come off it. Don't say it. Don't say it. It's not true.
It's already been said, Michael. I understand what you're saying. I get it.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
1-0 to you. We'll be back.
Anyway.
And I saw that show in Rome with Angus Deaton was playing the straight man.
Yeah, he did. So he did
Richard
it for years.
Did it originally.
Richard did it originally, yeah. And then and I think he did it. And then Angus took over and did it in the West End. And then they went to Broadway. And I remember Angus saying, you know, almost that, well, bye, everyone. We had a party and all shook his hands and said, bye, see you. He said, if you're ever in New York, you know, look me up. And basically sort of rented out his flat in London and just said, I'm off to New York. It's going to be great. And they all went off to New York and they did the opening night. And the big critic in New York absolutely slated the show and it closed the next night.
Oh, no.
That was it. So, you know, Rowan, who is enormously successful, had that incredible failure in America. And Angus was back. I mean, it's like, it's almost like you said, oh, well, I'm going to really miss him. I'm going to, and you turned and went, Angus, I thought you'd just gone, oh, you're back. And there he was, back in the room. And it was never mentioned again, I think.
Yeah. You know. But you sort of, you fell into comedy. You were an actor. You're doing lots of acting at university.
Yeah, exactly that.
And you sort of fell into comedy almost by mistake through meeting Angus. Is that right?
Well, exactly through meeting Angus. Yeah, he auditioned me for the review. I mean, I was going to go up to Edinburgh and do serious stuff. I did do serious stuff. I did four other plays, I think, while I was up there, and the review the first year I was up there. And the four other plays were absurd things. We did a thing called The Lorenzaccio Story, where they had a scene in it where everybody, apart from me and Tim McInerney, everybody else was behind us, standing in a line, stark bollock naked. And to this day, I don't know why. And it was directed by a bloke called Jeremy Howe, who I think is head of Light Entertainment or head of the BBC Drama or something now, but he's very powerful. Or he may be in charge of the Archers, something like that. You know, he did it and he thought this was a very important scene. Unfortunately, there was a bloke in the cast who had the biggest cock you've ever seen in your life. It was really huge, a down to the knee cock, one of those, you know. And so it was pointless doing this scene. Tim and I used to pull faces at each other because we knew nobody was looking. And then we did one show where there was an audience of three, and there were 15 of us in that cast. And at one point, 13 of them were naked and in front of three people, one of whom was my wife-to-be, who was sitting there knitting.
Is that how you met?
No.
At least he hasn't got his cock out. It'll be a surprise.
If I'd met her after the man with the cock, she would never have gone with me. No, it's no good. No. It would have spoiled everything for her. But luckily, she was stuck with me by then. So she was, she was my girlfriend, and we are now married, still married. And she was sitting there knitting, I think, through the entire thing. All I could hear was this tick, tick, tick. And then another lady who I'm sure had come to see something else, because she kept, every time there was a blackout, you'd come back and she'd be a seat up. She'd slowly moving up the auditorium in the hope that she would manage to get to the exit without upsetting us. It was terrible. Anyway, we did that, but we did the review in the evening. And I think almost certainly as a result of the fact that at the end of the review, we sang this brilliant parody of the Bee Gees that Philip Pope and Richard Curtis had written, a thing called Meaningless Songs in Very High Voices, and we were called the Heebie-Jeebies. And we had sort of leather jackets on and wired scarves and all that sort of stuff. And it's a very funny song, still is to this day. And we were approached almost immediately by people who said, do you want to record this? Do you want to make a record? And then Jimmy Mulville, who actually runs Hattrick Productions, or owns Hattrick Productions, he was a radio producer at the time, and came and said, do you want to do a pilot for the BBC? So we did a pilot when I was in my third year at university. So it was a very strange thing to be, it's like, oh, this is easy. This acting lark. It's brilliant.
Well, that's why by the time I was in Edinburgh, everyone was going, if you're at Oxford, they just get you on TV straight away, and everyone hated us. So I had a terrible time as a result of.
Well, I think that may be true.
Overnight successes.
Although everything gets paid back eventually. We did KYTV. We went on and did that radio show, and it was called Radioactive, and we did seven series of that, and it won loads of awards. It even won an award, an absurd title for an award. It was called the Primas Ondas Award, presented in Spain. And the title of it was Best Radio Program in Europe.
Right.
So for a silly comedy show to win that's not bad, is it? The BBC were impressed. I think the BBC have only won it three times in their history. Right. Anyway, we won this award. And then we went to the telly and did KYTV. And we won the Montreux Festival as well. And they got us together and said, well, fantastic, we're so pleased. Your career is safe with the BBC. And, of course, I didn't work for the BBC for 6 years after that. They cancelled the thing. And this is where I'm talking about, everybody gets caught up eventually, because we were thrown out to a large extent because the day-to-day came along and on the hour. And, and who wouldn't throw us out for on the hour? I would. And so Patrick Marlborough and Chris Morris and Steve Coogan and everything came in, and Rebecca Front, and who I think you've met Rebecca, haven't you?
I know all of those people vaguely. Yeah. I did write for On the Air, and then I was thrown off On the Air. Well, we left On the Air for the day to day.
Yeah,
it was a mutual decision. I wonder what life would have been if we hadn't. But the Heebie Jeebies, which I do remember, great. The thing with for me, Radioactive. My brother got into Radioactive, and then got me into Radioactive. I think KYTV. I was watching some of it today, and I don't think I saw that much of it. I think it came out at a time when I was probably at university and didn't have a TV, I think. So I was listening to the radio. I was still listening to a Radioactive. But there's a big chunk of my life where you kind of miss out on stuff. I definitely saw some of it, and it's great. But we loved Radioactive. But the Heebie-Jeebies, let's talk about first.
Yeah, okay.
Because that was a sensation. You travelled all over the world. You were caught up in Live Aid almost.
We had some quite ridiculous things. It's really odd. I've never quite understood how, when you're doing a parody of someone or you're pretending to be someone, people start treating you as if you are that person. So we did a tour of Australia where we were constantly being, we go to nightclubs and people would say, this way, and they take us to sort of closed off areas. We did one, and then suddenly this man said, I'm sorry, would you mind if we did a fashion show for you? And we went, yeah, all right. And all these extraordinary women came in and paraded in front of us in different clothes, and we're going, very nice, thanks. Well, it's 11 o'clock at night. We've just, what's going on? It was madness. And we would, I think maybe, we had a manager called Martin Bergman, who you may know is also an ex-Cambridge footlighter, but he was a brilliant man. He would always ring places up and say, hello, yes, it's Martin Bergman here. I'm the manager of the Bee Gees. And there we go. Sorry. Yeah, the Hebrides. And we got into all sorts of places. We went to the Melbourne Cup to see the races that Martin arranged for us. And he said, we're going to the Melbourne Cup, everybody. So we went, okay. So we turned up in shorts and T-shirts. And they said, you can't go in the – he said, stand back. Hang on a minute. I'll go and talk to them. And he went forward. And apparently he said to this man, did you get the telegram? And the man said, sorry, sir, I don't know who you are. He said, Martin Bergman, the man at Ascot, the steward at Ascot. He said he would send a telegram to you. I'm here with the Bee Gees. And the man got into a panic and said, I'm sorry, sir, we haven't got it. He said, oh, this is absolutely ridiculous. I've never known anything. So what sort of organization is this? Make a great big fuss. We were shown through to the Royal Enclosure and provided with suits and jackets and, you know, and things and just given loads of champagne. It was brilliant fun. And we did go at one of those. They had a sort of a Live Aid thing in Australia. They had their own Live Aid concert. And we were put on the top of the bill because we were the only foreign act. So they had, you know, people like Men at Work and even In Excess, they regarded New Zealanders as being sort of the same, you know. So as the only foreign group, we went on, and now finally, ladies and gentlemen, will you please welcome the Heebie-Jeebies? And you've heard a great roar of who the fuck? And we wandered on and sang to our backing track. It was absolutely absurd. But I remember turning up to that thing. We turned up, they sent this enormous limousine, and we were all picked up and we went to this thing and we were dropped at the gates of the limousine. And this enormous crowd of girls came charging towards us, and that's, we thought, wow, God, we're a hit. And then we got out the car and they got about 10 feet from us and then went, nah, and turned and walked away. that is a very disappointing thing when you're, you know, when you're basically 23 and you think, you know, I've made it, here we go. And no, they weren't interested at all.
Oh dear! Well, what did you do? Whole was there an album? Was it enough songs for an album with the Heebie-Jeebies?
Yeah, it was. We did two albums. In fact, we did. They said, "Can you do anyone else?" So we said, "I don't know. We'll have a go." So we started writing other songs. We did David Bowie. We did Status Quo, Paul McCartney and Wings, and the Eagles, Prince. Just load, you know, Spandau Ballet. We just did whoever we wanted to, which of course led on to the fact that, you know, having done all that, we were then, I think probably we were asked if we wanted to work on Not the 9 o'clock News, which was still going at the time. And I think rather foolishly, we thought we're going to hold out for our own series. and then Spitting Image came along. So it was John Lloyd twice, really. John Lloyd eventually sort of got his way. And said, "Will you come and do the same sort of thing on that?" So we did. We went and did Spitting Image, and ended up doing all those songs on that, you know, which was brilliant fun.
Yeah. Well, and we'll talk about it. I think we'll have to mention it. I know you've talked about it a lot, but you were the lead singer on the Chicken song, which I think again, people of a certain vintage will remember.
Yeah, I had a strange fascination with number ones. After that, I suddenly thought, I've had a number one. I've been to number one. It's a very weird feeling. I was on holiday when it went to number one. And because, you know, in those days, you didn't have mobile phones and things. I had no idea. And I came back to find my answer phone. It was just hundreds of messages. I thought, oh, my God, my dad's dead, you know. But what it was, people were saying, congratulations, how brilliant. And nobody said what it was for. And I thought, what have I done? I don't know what I've done. And then... we looked at Phil Pope rang me and said, it's number one. And I went, oh my God, how extraordinary. So I wandered around thinking, oh, what do I do? I'm number one. And actually what I did was I went to W.H. Smith and then went up to the counter and said, have you got a thing called, have you got a chicken? It's a chicken song thing. She went, yeah. I said, oh, right. She said, do you want the 12-inch version or the single? And I said, I'll have both. And she wrapped them up. And then I did that. You know, you must have done this, Rich, that thing where you just can't resist it, although you know it's a stupid thing to do. I actually went to her, yeah, that's me singing that. And she went, is it? And that was it. That's all I got. I'd say, Yeah.
You have to go around with the puppet all the time, the puppet that sings the main thing.
A Groovy Gang badge. If I'd had a Groovy Gang badge.
It's me, the puppet under the. But you were quite canny. I heard this today on another podcast everyone else just took a flat fee for recording it. Because it was in the TV show first, right? And I presume they just went, oh, for a bit of fun, we'll release it.
Soon. Yeah, absolutely. That's what it was.
It was taking the piss out of Black Lace Agadoo, all that sort of. There was a big hit, number of hits in the 80s of these sort of meaningless. Stupid songs.
Absolutely.
And it was a very funny pastiche of that.
Yeah,
everyone else just took the £1,000 and you decided to take the percentage point.
That's exactly right, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did because, you know, I mean, I didn't have the experience to know that it was wiser to take the money, take the fee, you're going to get some money, you're actually going to make some money. And I went, no, it's just, I've never been on a record before that, I thought, you know, I'm the lead singer on this. I'm going to, let's take a gamble. And of course, it sold 750,000 copies. And the other people were on it to this day. There's Kate Robbins was on it. You know, you've had Kate as a guest. And, and she to this day, she always calls me Mr. 0.5%. Oh, you and your fucking percent. Yeah. How much did you get? Come on. I know. I said, it wasn't much. I didn't buy many houses, Kate. You know, just wind her up. Well, it wasn't
much. You know Rodney from Only Fools. Let's say that. It wasn't that. One a week.
No.
But you did do a lot of ads in that because it's quite unusual that you became quite wealthy as an actor straight away.
Yeah.
Which must have been a nice thing.
Yeah, I've got gradually poorer. It's been just start. I've done the opposite of what I should have done, which is I was going to have I was going to be a lawyer. So I would have started out, you know, struggling. Can I make it? I'm just a young junior and I might get a case, you know, and now I'd be living in an enormous house in the country and have a place in Italy and all that sort of thing. So I've done the opposite. I started earning ridiculous sums of money and slowly just gone, you know.
I mean, I suppose there's two schools of thought, because funny, I talked, me and Stu worked with, we did a sketch show with Patrick Marber and Steve Coogan before everything kind of took off. We'd done On the Hour together and we did a sketch show in Edinburgh, trying to bring back the sketch show in 91 or 92. But both of them, I think Patrick came from quite a wealthy family anyway. I think he had his own flat in Angel already. Mm. And Steve, you'd go around to Steve Coogan's house because he was doing so many adverts, he would literally have checks for more than we were going to earn in the year.
I know.
Just lying on the floor that he hadn't even bothered to take to the bank yet. You know, there was just mail.
I'm not sure that world exists anymore, but it was fairly mad. It was a crazy world. You know, I mean, I once went in and did a voiceover for Barclays Bank, and it was just the end line saying, you know, Barclays Bank, da-ba-da-ba-da-bum, something like that, you know, gibberish. And it was, and then I rang my agent and said, yeah, I've done that. She said, oh, right. Was it? I said, it took about 10 minutes. She said, okay. Look, it's going on 10 commercials. They're going to use it for 10 commercials. So really, I've looked at the equity agreement and they should pay you £120,000. But we're going to do a deal for 55. All right. I mean, what sort of question is that? It's absurd, isn't it? I should be ashamed of that. I should also say, where the fuck is it? You know, but things like that are absolutely ridiculous. I look at sort of young actors now and think, you're just never going to get that chance. You know,
do you think, though, that in some ways, you know, we stayed poor and we kind of were just jealous of them for having all this stuff. But then you're more driven to, I mean, not that you haven't worked, but you're more driven to work. If you've got a bit of comfort and a bit of,
yeah, I've absolutely never been. Well, I've never been that interested in the money, which is why probably I'll just take the job. You know, people say it's this much money. I go, yeah, fine. I very rarely turn things down. I actually did turn down a job today, strange enough. Having been, you know, what, locked down for 6 months, the first job offer I get, I go, nah, I'm too comfortable. I don't want to go out. I want to stay indoors.
It's nice staying in, isn't it? I kind of like that.
This was flying to Spain and you know, all that sort of malarkey. And I thought, no, I don't want to come back and isolate. So I turned a job down, you know.
Fair
enough. I mean, I'm sort of in that position now where I sort of go, well, this is nice. I'm having a nice life, you know. And thank God you're paying me, though.
Of course.
Yeah.
You'll be able to buy a house.
Yeah, yeah.
Off of this, definitely. It's going to be fun.
Enough of money. I'm really not interested in it. I've never, honestly, never been motivated by it. And I don't think you should be.
I don't think you should be as well. I think that's true. But I think that it equally, as you say, it means if you're not worrying about money, then you can take a job that you think, oh, this looks like an interesting job, rather than I've got to find something.
Yeah, I've done loads of those. I've done loads of those sort of going off and doing plays. People have said, why are you doing that? I mean, in fact, I turned down, I was supposed to go to do a commercial for in somewhere gorgeous, like some sort of fantastic paradise island. And they said, this is the money, and it was ridiculous money. And it was for a German chocolate bar. And Reason's Chews, they're called. And I was supposed to go and do this commercial. And they said, Doug, it's easier if we just put you on a package holiday. So, you know, because it's quite expensive to fly out there and fly back. So do you mind going for 2 weeks? And I said, no, don't mind. They said, actually, do you want to bring your family? I went, okay. And then the next day, I was offered Only Fools and Horses.
Right.
And so I cancelled the commercial. I did Only Fools and Horses for 500 quid.
Yeah.
And, that's a good decision.
Yeah, because no one would be coming up to you going, you've got any Reese's chocolate on you?
A chew, chew, chew?
They might be, and then you have to give out chocolate, and that would be harder to get come by.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's a few things on here that I want to talk to you about that I have not heard you talk about. You were in Tiswas, which was my absolute favourite show.
Yeah.
You played Norris Cribb. Do you remember being on Tiswas?
Yeah, that was we went on several times, in fact. Right. Yeah, one of the occasions that I remember is we were doing a show. We were on tour and we were in Stirling in Scotland doing a show. So we did a show in Scotland in Stirling at night. And then our stage manager, we hired a camper van and we drove from Stirling to Birmingham, where they filmed Tiswas. And we parked outside the place, got there about 4 a.m, and we parked outside and got a little bit of sleep. And then we went in and we walked into Tiswas and the bloke said, hi, all right, great, give a change to your dressing room. And we went into the dressing room and he said, I'm sorry, but, you know, we're a bit crowded today. Do you mind sharing? And we said, that'd be all right. And in we went, and there, standing at the sink with his shirt off, having a shave, was Sting. And I absolutely, if he'd said to me, you know, will you marry me? I would have done. It was one of the most gorgeous sights I've ever seen. And he went, hi guys, you know, and we went, hiya, Sting. You know, it was very weird. And then then we went on and did the show and it was great fun. And we went back several times.
Well, again, it was one of the, I think, me being a little bit too young for Python, I never saw Python on TV. Things like The Goodies and Tiswas were my introduction to that kind of anarchic humor. I basically thought Tiswas had created that sort of humor, which they did to some extent. They sort of created, I suppose, the gunge element of TV that then became very popular on adult TV years later. But it was sort of an anarchic show with an amazing cast of disparate people. But it meant when I moved to the Southwest from the Midlands, the guy came and fixed up our TV and my sister said, is Shang-A-Lang on? Because she was a big Basic Rollers fan. Oh, yeah, that's on. And I said, is Tiswas on here? And he went, no. And I cried because Tiswas wasn't.
They didn't
show. I was 28
you.
Years old as well. That's
I mean, from that, Helen Atkinson Wood, who was in Radioactive, was picked up by Chris Tarrant and went on and did the adult version of that. He did OTT.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, we are absolutely talking about things. Nobody has the faintest idea of what we're talking about.
They do. They love this. Will be going down well with my
they'll be Googling
middle-aged demographic.
Okay, that's good.
It's going to be fine. You were in Home James.
I was in Home James.
That's the Jim Davidson.
Jim Davidson, yeah, where he was the chauffeur. Yeah, I played a sort of a posh bloke. I can't really remember it very well. I do remember that I didn't like him. I really didn't, you know, and that's not common. I get on with most people, and it's a very strange thing. You know that thing when people immediately, you think, so, well, this is your television program. You're the star of it. And the moment he met me, he went, yeah, of course, you know, I mean, I'm probably one of the biggest stand-ups in the country now. I mean, the shows I do, and it just launched into this great thing of just a list of things as to why he was great. And yeah. I thought, well, I sort of know that. You know, why are you telling me? It's very strange, isn't it?
Well, there's a weird insecurity with certain, some people don't have it. I think, again, I heard you talking about the Only Fools and Horses cast being very welcoming.
Yeah,
and
lovely.
And chipping ideas and stuff like that. And I guess you can be insecure. They could have been insecure, those guys. They could have, what if the next show isn't the big show? But they probably felt fairly secure.
I think maybe that was insecurity with him. I think it probably was. He felt that he needed to sort of, you know, in a way, I suppose, the problem is that he suddenly thinks, well, here I am in a world full of actors, and I'm not an actor. Yes. And so he, you know, I can understand it, but I didn't particularly like him. I've come across him once or twice since, and I don't know. There's something about that world that I don't like, you know, where other people from that world who I've come across are just brilliant. Shane Ritchie is one of the most entertaining and funniest. When we did Benidorm together, and he was absolutely fantastic, and he's got no fear at all of, you know, those things where people sort of go, oh God, people are looking at me, the public know I'm here, the public, you know. He turned up at this hotel, said, Anna, Mike, yeah, great, right, so we're going for a swim. I went, yeah, sure. Okay. So I said, where do you want to go? And he said, well, the pool. I said, but it's a, you know, loads and loads of people there, Shane. And he said, yeah, be all right. No, it's all right. No, it's no problem. No problem, mate. No problem. We went down and he spent the next 5 hours talking. Hello. Yeah, Shane. Yeah. It's Alfie Moon. Yeah. All right. Okay. Yeah. Come around my place. I'll give you one. Yeah. Hey. All right. See you, love. Bye. Bye. Yeah. Of course I will. Take just photos and everything. It's extraordinary. So you can never, don't ever define people by the sort of, in a way, the area of the business they come from. He's a brilliant bloke, but, you know, so it's nothing.
Sort of, I think it's interesting because you sort of parachuted into some, I mean, not Benidorm because you've had a recurring role in that, but in a lot of these other shows, you've parachuted in for one episode.
Yeah.
So you get a sort of bird's eye view of what the people are actually like, you know, because if you're a cast member every week, then you're going to sort of become part of the team.
Yeah.
But in a way, they also, you're going in every now and again.
They're invested in keeping you on board, I think, if they know you're coming back, you know, whereas you can either just say hi and have nothing more to do with people, you know, or you can go, hello, great to have you on for this week. Oh, yeah, no, and you can chat. And that's exactly what Only Fools and Horses did. David Jason was just brilliant. He said right at the start, okay, now everybody stay around. Don't just rehearse your scene and go home, because it's really nice to have other actors in here. We can bounce off you. And if you've got any ideas, come, you know, put them forward. We played a fantastically evil game at lunchtime every day, which was, you'll like this game. It's called Look Away. It was basically we had to pick the most famous person in the restaurant at the North Acton rehearsal room, and that was absolutely rammed with everybody who was on television. And I remember picking Nigel Hawthorne, and what you had to do was one by one, you had to sort of slightly catch their eye and go, "I," and just nod at them and just give that sort of friendly, you know, as if you knew them look. And we did it over the whole period of the lunch, very slowly. And the idea that David said was that the moment that they acknowledge you and wave back, you all look past them and watch them crumble. It's wicked. It's a wicked thing to do. But we did it. We did it every lunchtime, and it was very funny.
Poor Nigel Hawthorne. He never recovered from that.
He never did. His career was crushed. He just completely lost his confidence. And then he went mad, apparently. Did you see that film where he went mad?
I did, yeah.
He apparently turned into a nutter.
What's the little girl in Outnumbered really like? I bet she was horrible in real life.
No, she wasn't.
I bet she's a diva.
No.
swearing, drinking.
I know, yeah, absolutely. Well, the really annoying thing is that they're better than you. That's the thing, you know, these bloody children. You go in there and they are just so good. And not only that, it's really interesting that those kids are all having lessons all day long. So they're being tutored while you're filming. So we would film everything and then they would be shipped in for about an hour. Right. So if you, the interesting fact about Outnumbered, which I can say, and this is a little known fact, is that apart from Hugh Dennis and Claire Skinner, I'm in more episodes than anyone else because I did all the recordings for the background noises, so the radios and the televisions and all that sort of stuff. So, in fact, I'm in loads and loads of episodes, but nobody knows I'm in them. But the one episode I was in, when the children are not in vision, they're not there.
Right.
So you really make sure you admire what Hugh and Claire do, you know, because you sort of go, wow, that's amazing. All those scenes where you're having arguments with the kids, if it's a close-up of you, those children are having lessons. You're doing it to an AD with a script, you know. It's brilliant. So then, of course, they turn up and they're not actually given a script. They're told to, you know, the idea of the thing and then say things. And the little one, yeah, the girl you asked me about, she did a line in it, which I thought, that's extraordinary to have that nerve. She said, yeah, all right, Mr. Piggy Eyes. It's all right, yeah, okay. I've not got the biggest blue eyes in the world, but it was.
See, she was a monster.
She's a monster.
She was a monster.
A monster and should never be allowed to act again.
She shouldn't have been allowed to grow up because
they could have used drugs, like, you know, Nadia Comaneci,
or cloned her and just kept on bringing up. It got weird. They grew. I mean, they're adults now, aren't they? They're all grown up, basically, the kids. So it's freaky when they. It's not right. They shouldn't be grown up.
And one of them's called Tiger.
Yeah.
And it's not fair, is it?
No.
Not in life. Not really. So this is your bank manager, Tiger. What?
Well, his dad is bend over, isn't that right? His Tiger's dad is bend over the
adult
film actor.
Yeah.
I believe so, and his mum is as well, I think. Mm. So, you know, well done. Bendover was 1 year in Edinburgh, was doing a show after my show.
Yes.
And Bendover, at the end of his gigs, most people have T-shirts or books to sign, he would have dildos of his own penis.
Modelled on his penis.
That he would sell to people and people would buy him. So I should have done that. I don't know if that was before Talking Cock. I think that was before Talking Cock. I should have done that with Talking Cock. I should have said, right.
While we're on ideas, I want to ask you a question. While we're on the ideas of, you know, having an idea and then not doing anything about it, I had an idea for a Black Mirror episode the other day.
Okay.
Based entirely on the fact that now I've got involved in podcasts, I noticed that they fund themselves to a large extent by saying to people, well, if you want to listen to it, you sort of got to listen to a little bit of advert first. And I thought, what if the world was like that? So, in fact, if you wanted to turn on your light, unless you were rich and could afford to, you know, get it without the advert, you'd press a switch and it would say, "New Sanzo Osram bulbs. They're the best bulbs in the world. Buy your bulbs from Sanzo." Then the light would come on. And if you wanted to start your car and get cheaper petrol or whatever in your car, you'd turn the switch and it would do an advert for new tires and stuff. So everywhere you go, there's adverts. Not only that, because adverts are specific, like they are on podcasts. They know what your listening is and what your buying, you know, preferences are. So they aim it at you. That would also be the case. So you could have a situation where somebody turned up with a parcel from, you know, Amazon or something, and they'd knock on the door. And in order to get to the free delivery, you'd have to have an advert. So you open the door and the man says, "Bussy dominatrix," and while your wife's in the background. And then you go, "Oh, no, I'm sorry, you got the wrong address." They go, "No, absolutely, we know you. We know all your buying rates." So do you think that would be – do you think
– I don't think you should do it on Black Mirror. I think you should do it. Just like, well, let's start up that as a bit – I mean, you've given away the idea now. You've ruined it.
I know. What I've done is I've – no, what this. I've done is I've copyrighted it. My boot.
But we should – don't do it, because if you, I sent a Black Mirror idea to Charlie because he was on, and it was only just in. I can't remember what it was now, but it was quite a nice idea. And then the next week or a couple of weeks later, his wife was on, and I said, "Oh, you know, I sent him some, but it was sort of only a joke. It was something we talked about." And she said, "Oh, he can't even read it. He's not allowed to read anything that's sent to him."
Really?
So that he can't, you know, people can't, which is what I do as well. People send me scripts, I just say, look, I can't read this because
In case they then say, well, you've seen it and it was my idea.
And so if anything comes up later, if you don't open it and don't look at it, then there's nothing they can do. So, yeah, don't give it to Brooker. Okay, he will just ignore it.
We'll put a warning at the beginning of this episode of the podcast. Charlie Brooker, if you're listening, don't. You'll be in big trouble.
He'll be very excited. I'm sure he was a big Radioactive fan as well. He's the right generation. Let's talk about your podcast, because I have been on it, and it's a lovely idea for a podcast. And was it your first introduction to podcasts?
Absolutely. I've become a podcast virgin. I don't think I'd even listened to one, which is mad. And it's my son who drove me to do it. He kept saying to me, do a podcast. Have you not heard what Richard Herring's doing? Do a podcast. And I kept saying,
he can do it.
Yeah, for God's sake, it's easy. And I just ignored him for about 3 years. Kept saying, go away. And then eventually I thought, well, you know, I'll have a go. I'll test the waters. So I emailed a few people to say, look, I've had this idea, which is a very simple idea. I just say to you, you know, it's called My Time Capsule, and then you tell me the five things from your life you'd like to put in a time capsule. And four of them are things that you like, and one of them is something that you find a bit embarrassing or you'd like to get rid of. And that's it. And what do you think? And everybody came back saying, that's a really good idea. You did. You know, it came straight back and said, that's a really good, nice idea. Yeah, I'd love to do that. And I thought, maybe it's going to work. You know, I mean, when Stephen Fry comes sort of back within minutes and goes, darling, you know, and you think, so, well, yeah, okay, I'll have a go. And I'm really enjoying it. I really like it. I'm really into podcasts now. I love it.
I think it's nice you've got access through all these people you work with to like this amazing potential.
For one
cast.
Week. Yeah, I work with all these people for 1 week. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But you're afraid, you know, but it is, I suppose it's a little bit similar, although I don't know. I often have guests on I don't know at all.
Yeah.
You had Griffith Jones on, who's never done a podcast.
No, he's never. And I don't think he ever will again, because he's not bothered about things like that. You know, why would he? He's got no need for it, you know. And actually, I went round to his house. And God, what a house! In Fitzroe, I won't say where it is. And it's just a beautiful house. It's this fabulous house. And we sat in his kitchen, which was a bit like being in Albert Hall. Not good for sound effects, but he just sort of just didn't hold back at all. Yeah. But why would he? He has nothing to protect. You know, he's done it all. You know.
Well, I think it was before the podcast we were talking about this, but like when people have made it that far, they will talk a lot more openly about stuff and are very good fun guests. And often when people are just starting out, they're very good fun guests.
Yes.
It's the people in the middle who are kind of worried about where things are going. don't have a massive house in the middle of London. But yeah. Have you been asked? I'd be interested in what's the one thing that you, the bad thing that you would put in your time capsule. You must have thought about this yourself.
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. See, now people tend to go for something that's a bit funny, you know, and I don't blame them, actually. You know, you don't really want to go completely soul searching. I was a bit of a twitcher. Which is appropriate, isn't it? So, yeah, are they called Twitcher or Twitters? Yeah, I used to go bird watching and with a mate of mine. And we were once grabbed by this gang when I was 12 years old. And we were marched off to a wood. Now, you're really worried where I'm going now, aren't you? Yeah. No, but they
take this kind of thing. We can do this.
No, they tied us to a tree and fired arrows at us.
What, full-on real arrows?
They'd made themselves, but they were bows and arrows they'd made themselves, but they were stuck in the trees.
Wow.
It was really terrifying.
Yeah,
And the only way to get out of it was if they eventually said, well, right, we'll let you go if your best fighter fights our best fighter. And because these lads were about 14, 15, so they were big lads, and we were tiny. And my mate, who from that day was not my mate, said, he's the best fighter. And they untied us and let him go. And he ran. He ran like the wind, you know. And I had to basically take a beating from this bloke. And then they let me go. So I'd like to get rid of that, because every now and again it crops up again. You know, it's just one of those, you know, you go, oh, shit, that wasn't nice.
It's a weird thing. I mean, I was thinking, that's obviously, again, when you have kids and you relive things a bit through your kids. And you know, I was thinking it was nowhere near as bad as that. But There was a time I was at a track event. My sister was a good runner and she was doing a track event. And I went off to play in the playground and there was no one really around. And there was a little tunnel you could go through. And I got halfway through the tunnel and then two older kids. And I was probably about eight. I was probably eight and they were about 10. But they had a little penknife and were kind of threatening me with a penknife. And I think because I didn't cry and freak out, they went, yeah, you're right, mate. You're all right. You know, and then they accepted me as a friend. But I was literally, you know, very terrified. I was about to be stabbed to death.
They never needed these things. They never,
and it's really stuck with you that
I would.
And
then things. I went into a swimming competition when I was in junior school. Mrs. Thistlethwaite was the teacher. I'm going to name her, bitch. And she said to me, I said, can I swim 440 yards instead of 220? Which is, you know, and get the 440-yard badge for my swimming costume. And she said, no, you'll never do it in time, Michael. It's not possible. And I said, no, I'm really fast swimmer, miss. Let me have a go. And so she said, all right, if you're going to show off. I said, you know, that's not fair. Just I'm a good swimmer. And so I did it. And she didn't really monitor me because I was swimming up and down faster than the other kids. And I got to the end and I got out and I said, I've done it, miss. I've done it. Looking up, thinking, you know, like 3 minutes to go. To the end of the lesson, I've done it. And she said, no, there's one length to go. And I said, no, it's either two lengths to go or I've done it.
Yeah.
So logically, there couldn't be one length. It's an even number. And she told me to go and get dressed and to, she put me in detention. And I never got the 440. Never.
I hate her as well.
We all hate her,
don't we? I wasn't very good at sport, but I was quite good at medium distance running.
Mm.
But the games teacher hadn't really realised that. And I did a 1500 metre race or something and came in second or third. And the teacher said, not, and I said, I've finished. He said, you have not finished, Aaron, go around again. So I had to go around again, do another 400 metres because he didn't believe that I'd done that well. But I was actually a pretty decent mile runner. And that sticks with you.
They really stick, don't they, these things?
It's
terrible. I broke my arm in a high jump at junior school.
Right.
And again was told to stop making a fuss. And when I got home and the bone was sort of almost sticking out of my flesh, my mother nearly fainted, although she was a nurse. And we went to the hospital and even the doctor went, oh! So
what school were you at?
I was
at school. The kids are being attacked.
Never send your children to Hogwarts. That's what I think. Never.
Well, it's a great podcast, and that's the kind of thing you can get on your podcast that you don't get on mine because I don't have the time capsule question, but I did this time.
Yeah,
it's called My Time Capsule Podcast. Do check it out. Amazing guests. It's well worth your time to listen to that. Everyone, it is fantastic. Did you leave your reading glasses at my house have you lost a pair of reading glasses?
Almost certainly, but I wouldn't worry about them because they're always from a pound shop.
Are they? Okay,
don't worry
about
it.
Because they're 2.0, mine are 1.5.
All right.
They look like these are very cheap ones as well.
Does that make it one all?
My eyesight's better than yours, but they're no good to me is what I'm saying. Yeah, okay. But I'll hold on.
But yeah, hold on, because eventually they will be.
It's a bit further, and that will be fine. Good. I meant to ask you that off camera, but, you know. There we
okay.
And,
oh, I wanted to ask you about Bella's pudding.
Yes, well, Bella's pudding.
You found the recipe. Yeah.
I've done the recipe. I remembered it for your podcast. It's one of the things I put in your time capsule.
That's right.
And then, unfortunately, you held on to that podcast, and I then mentioned it in Off Menu, and it exploded, literally exploded.
It could have been me.
But somebody... whose name escapes me at the moment. I've got it written up there because I've got the recipe up on the board back there, but I won't go and look. But Venkner, I want to say someone Venkner, it might be that.
Right.
Emailed me a recipe for something that is, I'm pretty sure, is if it's not, it is more or less it.
Yeah.
So I made it for James Acaster. I would have made it for you if you'd been the only one.
Well, I did suggest when we were doing it. No. I have a feeling that had I put mine out, it wouldn't have exploded. So, you know, I do my best, but I just don't have the hair to be James Acaster. No. What can you do? No.
But it was very, very sweet, and it wasn't nice when I made it. I was quite impressed by when I made it, how I looked and thought, oh, this isn't going to be it, and then you'd stir it and suddenly it changed, and then you've cooked it and suddenly it was solid. When I ate it initially, it didn't taste anything like it, and then I left it for the day, and then I ate it the next day, and it was bang on. So it's better be served hot, I think, but if you make it, wait a day and have it cold. Don't worry about the meringue so much. I did a pretty good job, but... off my tits on sugar. In that podcast, I ate some. and I eat a lot of sugar, so it must be sugary. I just went, poom.
We don't want to see you go poom.
No, I haven't been eating chocolate for like a year and a half. I gave up, I told you before, I gave up drinking, yeah. But I gave up chocolate at the same time. So I haven't eaten chocolate since 2018, except when occasionally little bits are cropped up in like a biscuit someone's given you or whatever, or some ice cream. But then my wife was eating 95% dark chocolate. I thought, well, that'd probably be okay because that won't push me back onto it. But I had one bite of that and I think my eyes went and I was, I haven't taken many drugs in my life, but if you want to have an amazing drug experience, stop eating chocolate for 18 months
and then do
and
it.
Then eat just a nibble of 95%.
Then you went out and you cleared 2 tons of stones at 4 o'clock in the morning. I know, yeah.
It was extraordinary. Let's talk. There's a lot more we could talk about, but you've been in Mr. Bean, but you were there with Rowan Atkinson at the kind of, not the birth of his creations, but because you worked with Richard.
Yeah. Quite early days, you know, all those things. I did actually, I went down to London to see Richard, in fact, to sign the contract for the Heebie-Jeebies for the album. Right. Because he was involved, he said, I've got all the contracts here, come and sign them. So I went down to London from Oxford on the bus, and I went to his place in Camden Town. And the Camden Town Boys, they were known as, I think they still are, that crowd of people who were all friends at that time, they're still called the Camden Town Boys. And I went in and we sat there and had, you know, tea and toast, and I looked through the contract. Even though I was studying law, I've never been able to read a contract. I just sort of pretend I am. I sort of go, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I never read it. So I didn't. And then I got to the end and I signed it. And then we were chatting. And all the time this was happening, this piece of piano music was playing in the background upstairs. But it kept stopping and starting and stopping and starting. And then eventually Rowan Atkinson came downstairs and they were sharing a place at the time. And he put the cassette in the thing and said, oh, hi, Mike. What do you think of this? And he put it down and he did the piano player sketch that he did at the opening of the Olympics.
Yeah.
And that was the first performance of it. So I saw the very, very first performance ever of that thing because Richard had not seen it.
Yeah.
And he'd, you know, I think it sort of sums up his nature, really, Rowan, that he'd been upstairs working on it for hours and hours and hours, just perfecting it. And then showed it to us, you know, and of course I thought it was perfect and Richard had several pages of notes, you know.
That's pretty extraordinary to get that one man. Now, if you can get Rowan Atkinson on your podcast, that would be an amazing
thing.
Yeah,
I mean, it really isn't. There are several people. There are a couple of people I'm going for. I will go for Rowan eventually. And I'm going for David Jason as well, you know. So they're the sort of people who don't, you know. But those sort of, those being at those extraordinary events, it's one of the real joys of this whole thing, I think, you know. I was we did the opening. Nobody knew it was going to become as big as this, but I remember the opening theater performances for Comic Relief when they had the idea of Comic Relief to raise money. Initially they did shows at the Shaftesbury Theater in London and they did 5 nights of shows, and we were invited to go and sing the Heebie-Jeebies song in it. And it had all these extraordinary people. It's got the famous sketch with Lenny Henry and Frank Bruno, sort of, you know, basically both pretend to be Frank Bruno, and Lenny Henry's better at it than Frank Bruno. It's got all those where he does the Philophilus Wildebeest sketch. You know, have you got any African in you? Do you want some? That joke, which I'm not sure is terribly PC anymore, but there you are.
It's okay for Lenny Henry.
It's okay for Lenny. You can get away with it. You can say anything. Anything at all. Anyway, we did this. And then at the end of it, we were told, look, don't, you know, when you've done your bit, don't go off, which you often do at these charity things because they go on and on and on. But, you know, it was so exciting. And people doing stuff and the people coming, you never knew who was going to come on next. And they said, stay around because at the end, we'll all go on and we'll all sing Feed the World. So I thought, wow, that's good. And so we then gathered in the wings as the last act finished. And Bob Geldof of Midge came out and, you know, it's Christmas time, said Bob, you know, sang Bob Geldof very badly. There's no need to be afraid. And Midge sang his bit. And then they came to the bit where you sing, it goes into the chorus. And we were all lined up in the wings. And when we all walked on and joined in, and I found myself standing in, I can't imagine how this happened, Rich, but I found myself standing right behind Kate Bush. And it was coming up to that moment. And it's a, that's a very exciting thing to do. And she turned round and she looked at me and she said, "And exciting." And I honestly, the idea that someone like Kate Bush would ever say something like that to you, you know, and you'd be part of it. It was the most incredible thing. The idea, and I love the fact that she'd never lost the wonder of it all. She'd never, you know, she wasn't so sort of big and done so much that she just went, just another gig. You know, she still had that real enthusiasm for the whole thing and thought it was magical. Yeah. Lovely.
I kind of hoped I'd marry Kate Bush. Didn't. I mean, I'm prepared. If she's watching, you should get Kate Bush on your one. She'd be good. If you're watching, Kate, I'm prepared to leave my wife and the kids to come even now. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
Even now.
I would run up that hill.
So I resent you for even getting to
Kate, I'm running up that hill.
I will run up the hill. I'll jump out the window. I'll run across the moors, whatever I need to do.
Babushka, babushka.
Well, it's no Michelangelo, but it's good. So, right, well, there's no more time. We've done it. We've done an hour. We've had a lovely time. We'll have to get you back on another time. Okay. And are you going to do more with the
We've done it. Maybe we did do a little tour last year and it was very good fun. But basically, it was an excuse for us all to go and have lunch together every day. That's what it was. We would sell merchandise and at the end of it, we'd add it all up and go, "Oh, we did well today. Okay, well, we can go to a really posh restaurant tomorrow." So we would just then look up in the Michelin star restaurants on the route we were taking and stop and have lunch. So it was a very self-indulgent tour, but brilliant fun.
And you're still because it's a difficult thing with a sketch group. You're still getting on.
Oh, we get on extremely well, yeah. And I mean, if anything, better, I think. We're much, much better with each other. We're much more honest. We don't ever get annoyed with each other particularly. It's, you know, we've all gone, yeah, you're doing that thing again. I don't care. You know, and it makes us laugh. It's much more fun. It's interesting. Yeah, John Cleese asked me that a long time ago. Do you still get on with people? Because, you know, we don't. And I went, oh, don't you? You know. I thought it's I did an audition for the A Fish Called Wanda. Right. I didn't get the part, sadly, but but I remember him saying that and thinking, well, do people not get on then? You know,
I think it's, you know, sometimes it's a good thing. I think there are people. Obviously, I've been in double acts, and sometimes things are good, sometimes things are bad. I think it's difficult when you're. I mean, you've been all around the world with these people and toured all around the world, so you've really got to like each other. I think it can often be. I think in Python, see, I think that's interesting. When I talked to Michael Palin, Terry had recently died, and I think Terry Jones and John Cleese rubbed each other up the wrong way quite badly. But I think that's what made it
probably
work.
Almost certainly. You know, yeah,
I think it was. I think they needed that, and I think John Cleese needed that irritant, and Terry Jones needed to be irritated by someone not getting, and because they were pulling in different directions. I think that's what made the whole of it so good, was going to make it difficult for them to stay together.
Yes, and Eric Idle just wanted to do Spamalot, really, didn't he? That's what he wanted to do, and eventually he did, and they were then they were all furious that he'd made all that money, and then they didn't have any of it. See, again, that's money. It's not worth it. You know, we had a brilliant time together. We had a fantastic. We were, you know, things were fractious, obviously, because you get tired and you get fed up with each other. But actually, the moment that we all stopped working together, we all just carried on going on holiday together, and that's when you have the most fun. You know, we would just have lunches and we would, you know, meet for lunch and we would gather together and, you know, anniversaries. And then, of course, sadly, Jeffrey Perkins died, who was in our group. He was probably one of the greatest men I've ever known. And that was that's a very binding thing, that when you've lost a great friend like that, you know. So there we are. Let's finish on a laugh.
Well, I hope you do more. I think it's such an important show. And yeah, I think for a lot of people coming up through that time as well, it's a weird thing with radio shows because they do sort of live on and they get repeated on Radio 4 Extra and that sort of thing. But I think they're all so much of their time that they mean so much to the people who kind of grew up through them or listened to them as they were coming up.
Yeah,
We did it
in Edinburgh, and the very pleasing thing is, because I'm terrible at trying to flog merchandise, I go out and play the queue, you know, come on, programs, here we go, sign programs, you want to sign, I'll sign it, you know, and I'm terrible, I'm like a running a market stall. But it means that I sort of get to meet the audience. And then there were lots of people there who came and went, oh, we'd loved Radioactive. And they were all sort of probably about your age. You know, they were teenagers when they listened to it. And then they were there with their teenage children. And you say, do you know what this is? And they go, well, they used to play it in the car. I don't really know. And then afterwards, because I'd rush out to sell more merchandise, shameless, I would meet these people. And I'd say to these kids, did you like it? They said, oh, yeah, it was really funny. And we were doing exactly the same material. We're doing stuff from the 80s, you know. So that's very pleasing, I think.
That's lovely. And it's a fun show, and it's a sort of silly show, and it's about silly ideas. Is that kind of cartoon? When you compare it to On the Hour, they're sort of in a similar area, but they come at it from such different directions.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I think I prefer Radioactive. I know that's difficult for me to say, I think the silliness, and the joy de vivre of it, and the characters in it are so over the top.
Yeah.
And great. I won't make you do them now. Let's wrap it up before I start asking to do quotes. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know who's on next week. We might not even do one next week because we've got a few in the can and I might have a rest. Yeah, you never know. But if you're listening at home, there will be one next week because that's how time works. Ladies and gentlemen in the chat room, please give it up for the amazing Michael Fender Stevens.
Thank you. Lovely to talk to you.
See you again next time. Goodbye. You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Michael Fenton Stevens. Thank you very much to Pest for providing the music. I'm indebted to my good friend and producer and co-director, Chris Evans, not that one. Thank you also to everyone at Acast, everyone at YouTube, everyone at Twitch, everyone at the British Comedy Guide, everyone at Go Faster Stripe. This is a GoFasterStripe.com. Sky Potato and Fuzz Production. Why not head to gofasterstripe.com/badges and become a monthly badger? Get loads of extra stuff, a chance to win loads of prizes, a chance to see hundreds and hundreds of backstage interviews and other exciting bits of video. You get a membership pack and cards. Something's fallen over. And it's brilliant, and all the money gets ploughed back into making more content. Or go to gofasterstripe.com, where you can buy my books, DVDs, downloads, and also downloads and DVDs from some of the finest comedians in the United Kingdom. Some of whom aren't world famous, but they're all really fucking good. So gofasterstripe.com. Chris Evans, not that one, doing fantastic work at the helm of that, and you should support him with all your heart. Stay safe, my fine friends. See you next time. Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.